Last time when we got together, I had this same basic thesis that we have written on the top of the page here, that God's words are for man as he is a creature of eternity. That is, with a body of dust, a functional capacity imparted by a life-giving spirit, and a new identity as a living soul. And that's established by a whole lot of contexts that follow the pattern of either body, spirit, and soul, or body, soul, and spirit, or whatever. The order is not always the same, but the truths are. And so what I want to do over the next little while, I want to point out how often these three issues come up in the scriptures, because I want you to see them as real biblical stuff and not just Daryl's new approach to stuff. And I say that because the material that I'm teaching has not been widely taught in the church centuries. So you just have to, be aware that I'm teaching you stuff that has not been widely disseminated, and therefore you need to be careful because I might be just leading you way off into the... But I don't want you thinking that, and that's why I want to go through some of these other places. But in order to do that, I want to make some things clear that I didn't manage to do last week. In our studies to date, we've kind of dived into the details that give us a description of man as God created him, because our interpretation of his words absolutely depend on our understanding of the setting in which the words fell. If we don't have the right context, words mean different things. The same words mean different things given different contexts. But we talk all the time, and we use phrases like all the time, when we don't really mean all the time. That's just the way we use language. So, last week, for a little bit, we looked at Galatians 3:11, which is an example of a text that's been much abused. It's a quote from Habakkuk 2:4, but it's not translated accurately in any of the texts that are on Bible Hub, which is over 20 English translations. And I used that as an illustration to show you that once we understood what Paul was saying in Galatians 3:11, we knew what the interpretation of Habakkuk 2:4 should be. So, there are wrong ways to take those words in Habakkuk, and there's a right way, and Paul gave us the right way there. I just used that illustration for the purpose of establishing the need we have to properly understand the words of God so that the purpose for which he gave it can be fulfilled in us. Therefore, I have been trying to make the case in these studies that God's words were given in view of the way he created us. That includes the body, the spirit, and the soul. Because he made a body out of dust, and he breathed the spirit of life into it, and we became then living souls. And the point of all of that is this. For man, this is the issue. And the answers put forth govern how we're going to understand the individual words of God as he gives them, and how we're supposed to take them. And what that means is, if our perspective, and that's what this whole study is about, developing a biblical perspective, if our perspective of God's purpose for the existence of our Bible is governed by a corrupt concept, it's going to automatically lead us into understanding the words improperly. But if the concept of righteousness, for example, is by means of man's obedience to God's commands, which we typically call work salvation. If you understand salvation as the outcome of the way you behave yourself, then you're going to interpret almost everything you read in the Bible according to that understanding. And as far as Paul's concerned, that's a misunderstanding. And that's how the Jews managed to have the Word of God in their presence for 1,500 years and then react so violently to the living Word when he appeared. They didn't like him, but they were diligent students of the written words. So that just proves you can take words the wrong way. And so what we want to do is make sure that we're understanding the words and letting them be governed by the way God gave them. And it's my contention that he gave them to us according to the way he made us. So my desire for this study this evening is for us to be able to see just how important it is for our right understanding of God's words to us to be believed within the context of the theme of promise and faith instead of obedience and law, or law and obedience. Those are the two big, that's where the whole issue of theology parts company. Every religion in the world except biblical Christianity operates on the basis of law and obedience. If you don't obey the law, you will not be able to inherit the kingdom of whatever God you are worshiping. Every religion in the world argues that way. But Christianity, from the biblical perspective, is a perspective of man who doesn't have the capacity to be that obedient. We are broken, wounded, distorted people. And as a consequence, we do things wrong on a fairly regular basis. And if our behavior is what's going to underwrite our future is going to be bad. But biblical Christianity is the only religion that actually comes right out and says that the message is designed for sinners. And that there's hope for us because our righteousness is in Jesus. His righteousness was perfect and it's already established in history. And I began to make this effort last week by looking into the original temptation of man by the devil in Genesis 3, and we didn't get very far. This evening I want to go a little bit further into Genesis 3 and maybe then go on to some other issues in Genesis. Genesis 3 is well known. You all know that that's the record of the temptation of Eve and Adam in the garden by the serpent, who is in the book of Revelation called that old serpent, the devil or Satan. They're all the three the same. It's just different designations. The serpent in the garden was the devil. The devil means the deceiver. But the devil is Satan, and Satan means opposer. So we know that Satan is the opposer, and he uses deception to oppose, and he started this as a serpent. So that's how it all works out. The point is, in the record of the devil's attack upon man in the garden, it was in order to get man to abandon God's words to be believed. That's the point. That's why the Bible starts with the issue of believing, and it ends in the last book of the Revelation, the last chapter of the book of the Revelation, with a statement that all the unbelievers are cast into the lake of fire. Unbelief and faith are the opposite issues, and they start in Genesis 3 because God said, "In the day you eat thereof, you will die." And the serpent said, "You will not." And that's just this point blank of contradiction, and you have to make your choice. The issue is that there was a great lie perpetrated in Genesis 3 that was the competitor argument for faith in the great lie as opposed to faith in the Word of God. God said, "You shall surely die," but that Hebrew phrase means literally, "Dying you shall die." That's why they didn't just drop dead as soon as they ate it. They began to die, and it took, in those days, it took over 900 years for the process to finally kill them. But after the flood, then the ages of man cut really radically in half, down to 70 years by the time Moses wrote the book of Genesis. So we went from living over 900 years on average to 70 years by expectation, Psalm 90. That was 1,500 years before Christ came. But the great lie was, you shall not die. And the strong implication of that great lie was, you can't trust that God you're trusting because He's already lied to you. And if He's lied to you once, He'll lie to you again. And if you can't trust Him, then you need to listen to what I've got to tell you. That's what the serpent said. And why they believed Him, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me. He came into the garden. He was a total unknown to them. Why in the world would they take His word as a total unknown? Why would they take His word for that? Well, they didn't want to before they fell. But I do think they were intimidated to. They were intimidated into considering that possibility. So the record is given in terms of the way that Satan attacked, and he did it on the basis of the way man was created. He was created as a physical being of dust that would need a constant supply of sustaining food and drink from a creator, from a source of supply that would not run out. Man as a creature is never going to be independent of his creator for the sustaining existence of his existence. He's not going to be able to exist if he isn't sustained. But God has said, once you become to exist, I'm going to sustain you forever after that. And that's, of course, the danger. Because forever after, that's a long time. And you need to be sure that your long time is going to be in the right situation so you can be filled with joy instead of in constant disaster. But because of that, we have the garden full of trees with fruit that they can eat. Any of those, the fruit of those trees, anytime they want to, they're not going to go hungry ever. So God had created them out of physical dust of the ground, and the trees pulled the nutrients out of the soil, turned it into fruit, gave it back to them as fruit. They ate it, turned into the nutrients that fed their dust bodies, and the cycle continued. Even in the new heavens and the new earth, the Bible tells us point blankly that the tree of life is going to bear fruit every month, and the leaves will be for the healing or the health of the nations. So even after we've been glorified and all that, we're still not going to be independent of God. We're still going to have His supply in order for us to continue to go forward. And we're going to get it. Satan attacked at that level because he presented that fruit as good for food. That's for the body. Then God created a functional being because He breathed spirit into this body. And the spirit enables the body and it begins to function and do and act. And that spirit was going to provide him with a supply of energy that would enable him to take action in case he might be led astray. If Adam believes Satan's lie, he's still going to take actions. But his actions will be determined by his lack of faith in God's words and his strength of faith in the devil's words. When he reached out his hand and took that fruit from his wife, his spirit was motivating the arm and giving it the strength to do that. So the serpent attacked him at that level, at the spirit of supplying energy, because he had already suggested that God couldn't be trusted. And if he can't be, then you need to be. Let me see if I can give you an earthy illustration. You have functional capacity. You're a living, moving being. But let's just say that you're in one of the spaghetti bowls in Dallas or Houston or somewhere like that on foot. And you want to get out of there because there's semis coming from all different directions. There's cars going whizzing by in every direction. And you don't know how you're going to get out of this mess unless you take certain right actions. And that's what the devil created when he inserted this unbelief and this tension in the hearts and minds of Adam and Eve, because suddenly they weren't in a safe place anymore. If God wasn't to be trusted, they couldn't count on the garden being a safe place anymore. So then they would have to take evasive actions in order to keep from being clobbered. That's the issue of the spirit. And that's why all the works of human beings are done by the Spirit, indwelling the body, empowering the works. But then the works have to be done according to what will deliver you, bless you, rather than get you killed. And then thirdly, man was actually became a living soul once he had this body-spirit unity. And in the living soul issue, the crucial identity is that as a creation that lived by regular participation in the fellowship of God, that God provided with them from Him as He was with them in the cool of the evening on the days. We're not told whether it was daily or weekly or whatever, but He was with them in the cool of the evening and they had this interaction. It was fellowship with God. And that's what sustained their souls, their identity as beings of God's creation who were fellowshipping with God and having the life of God as their emotional and mental experience. Their bodies were physically alive by the Spirit, but the bodies are not really where our life is. Our life is in the feelings and the emotions and the understandings and that kind of thing that fit into the soul, the nephesh. So it's at this point, from my perspective, understanding man as a living soul, I believe that whole idea of man is a living soul went off the rails. That's when people lost sight of what it means to be a living soul. It's not really difficult to understand Genesis 3:6 in terms of the body, because all of the trees of the garden were designed to maintain the body and its needs as a created entity, needing constant input. Anytime they felt hunger, all they had to do was reach out, grab something that was hanging off of a branch somewhere, and eat it. That was as easy as it could possibly be. They were surrounded by it. And it's not hard to understand then that this issue of the living soul thing was not about the body per se. It was about the fellowship thing with God, where the life really exists. And it's not difficult to understand Genesis 3:6 in terms of the Spirit, given faith in the lie. Because it's the actions of the Spirit that set all things in motion. And in a creation of cause and effect, everything a person actively does sets up a repercussion concept. It's called the law of cause and effect. When I hit the table with my finger, it makes a noise. It sets up certain vibrations, and it makes some kind of reaction in your thinking, whether you're constantly or fixated on it or not. It's still there. So the spirit issue is the issue of what you're going to do, and what you're going to do is going to be determined by who you trust. And if God's not to be trusted, then you have to have wisdom in order to protect yourself. In other words, Satan said, in effect, he's not as good as you think he is. He's using you, he's manipulating you, he's got some things designed for you that are going to create damage to you, and you need to have enough wisdom to be able to sidestep that, and if you'll eat that fruit, you'll get that wisdom. And ever since the fall, people have said, well, the devil was right. My life hasn't been pleasant all the time. I've suffered some heartache and pains and all that kind of stuff. Maybe God's not to be trusted. But all of that is rooted in the lie. And the only reason we have any issues of life is because of the lie. If you really believe that God's as good as he's cracked up to be in the Genesis account, you don't have to worry about anything. Yes, you'll still suffer some difficult things, but that's because of the fall. But just remember this, even Jesus, who was God in the flesh, the book of Hebrews says he learned from the things he suffered. So as a human being, suffering was a positive thing in that it taught you some things. But that brings us to the issue of the nephesh, the living soul. Since the eyes are a part of the body, the nephesh of the body. Now this is the nephesh of the body. It's the core, the torso. It doesn't include your legs, doesn't include your arms. It's that part of your body that your life is governed. I mean, you can live without legs, you can live without arms, but you can't live without the stuff that's in here. Now, this is where Genesis 3:6, like I said, I think this is where it went off the rails, because in the statement that the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was said by our translators to be a delight to the eyes. Now, I don't know what your translation says. Okay, pleasant. Chapter 3 in the New American Standard says, delight to the eyes, and the tree was desirable to make one wise. See, there's all three of those. It's food, delight to the eyes, and will give you the wisdom to handle an untrustworthy God. That's just so silly. How are you going to handle a God, whether he's trustworthy or not? He's God, for crying out loud. No creature is going to be able to outsmart him, even if he's as bad as Satan wants us to believe he is. You're still going to have to be subject to his power and wisdom because he's God. So it's just kind of silly. But anyway, they bought it. But the thing that throws everybody is verse 6 in the statement that the fruit of the tree was a delight to the eyes. Now, what in the world does that actually mean? We're going to talk about that. It obviously had some attraction to her, and that attraction was fed by her eyeballs. That's the physical nephesh. That's why they say that your eyes are the window to your soul. Well, they literally are when this is your soul. When the physical aspect of soul is here, the eyes are the windows. That's where you get your data. But in the metaphysical soul, the part that we have in terms of a relationship with God and interaction with God and having all of the fruit of the Spirit of God working in our experience, then the eyes and the whole issue of what you're seeing and what it means to have it to be a delight to them, that takes on some other issues. So I wanted us to think about the delight to the eyes in our thinking for the rest. It's not very long. The eyes are a part of the nephesh. That's the body. This is my nephesh, this part of my body. So it includes my eyes, my nose, my ears, my tongue, my lips, the larynx that I can talk with, lungs and heart and all that. So the eyes are part of it, and the question arises as to what the eyes fed into the nephesh that generated this sense of so-called delight. What was it about the fruit that Eve saw with her eyes that the translators didn't even know whether to translate it delight or pleasant or... See, this is where I have my problem with translations. They often use different words for the same word in different texts, and you wonder, no. Anyway, the word translated delight is used by Moses in only two places. This one, Genesis 3:6, and one in Numbers 11:4. I want you to look over at Numbers 11:4, because this is the other time that Moses used this word, and since we can't figure out what it means in Genesis 3, we're just going to look at another place where he used it and see if it gives us any help. Now, in Numbers 11:1, it says, the people became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord. Now, they're out in the wilderness and they don't like what's been going on, and they're complaining. So the people became like those who complain of adversity, even though they really didn't have any adversity. They had a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night to give them all the guidance they wanted. Whenever they needed any food, there was manna on the shrubs and stuff every morning. They had plenty to eat, plenty of water, all that kind of thing. They didn't have any adversity, but they thought they did. And they started complaining about it. And the Lord heard it, and his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of them on the outskirts of the camp. Now that's bad. You start complaining, all of a sudden you get fried by God. And of course, that feeds into the Satan's lie that he's not as good as he's cracked up to be. I mean, what kind of a God would burn people for complaining? Well, apparently one that gets angry about complaining. Complainers don't have any complaint about being penalized for their complaining. It's not legitimate behavior. But anyway, the people cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died out. So the name of that place was called Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burned among them. And the rabble who were among them had greedy desires. Now that's a two-word translation of the very word that's in Genesis 3:6. Instead of pleasant or delight, it's greedy desires. Now what are those? Well, it says that the sons of Israel wept again and said, "Who give us meat to eat? We remember the fish we used to eat free in Egypt." Yeah, free. You only had to work 7 days a week, 11 hours a day. But anyway, they got it free. The cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. And now our appetite is gone. There's nothing at all to look at except this manna. Now, manna was like coriander seed, and its appearance was like that of delium. And the people would go about and gather it and grind it between two millstones or beat it in the mortar and boil it in the pot and make cakes with it. And its taste was like the taste of cakes baked with oil. And when the dew fell on the camp at night, the manna would fall with it. That was about as easy a fast food restaurant as you can find. Now, you might have to eat hamburgers every day, but if it tastes like cakes baked with oil, what's the problem here? So Moses heard the people crying through their families, each man at the doorway of his tent, acting like babies. The anger of the Lord was kindled greatly, and Moses was displeased. So Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you been so hard on me, your servant? And why have I not found favor in your sight that you've laid the burden of all this people on me?" So Moses is starting to complain. Now the point that I want to make here is we get a picture of what it means to have a delight to the eyes. Except it's not delight. What is it? It's greedy desires. What are they greedy for? something different to eat.
Mine says, now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to the intense craving.
Yeah. For what? Something different to eat. We're sick and tired of this manna.
So that's what Eve did? She was craving that fruit?
Well, let me ask you this. What in the world did she need that fruit for? She saw it was food for the, you know, it was good for food. How'd she know it was good for food? And what did she need it for food for? She only had 100,000 other trees and all the fruit hanging on them to eat. So, yeah, I think Moses is telling us here what was going wrong in Genesis 3, and that was that Satan, by his great lie, had persuaded Eve to be discontented with the provision of God.
Don't we kind of do that with
things? I think we're all sinners in that regard.
Rather than not wanting a manna, would you want extra time today every day?
Well, if God was supplying them like he did the manna and he got upset with people who didn't like his provision, I probably wouldn't. I'd probably eat them all day long. After I'd read this Bible record.
Say in the middle of the garden you'd find a tree.
It says in the midst of the garden. Yeah, it just means somewhere. No, the midst is just in the group. It's kind of like they're in that midst of the table and I'm or room and I'm up here. But
we're all in the midst.
Yeah. But my point is this. In the context of Numbers 11:4, the problem was the discontent of the people with God's provision and a strong indication from God of his anger with them. And you know, he did give them meat.
Quail, yeah.
But what happened when they bit into it? Killed them.
Yeah.
The quail came in, what, knee high or waist high, all over the whole camp. There were millions of Israelites and they needed all these birds. But when they bit into it, a lot of them died right then on the spot. And it was another indication of God's attitude toward people who were ungrateful. They did not like his provision. Thanksgiving's coming.
He told them together just so many.
The manna.
Yeah. Just for one day.
Except on Friday. You're supposed to gather twice as much on Friday because Saturday is the Sabbath. You weren't supposed to go out and get it on Saturday. But if you gathered too much on Tuesday, on Wednesday, it was rotten. You gathered a bunch on Friday, and Saturday is just as good as it was on Friday. So that was another. But the indication of God's anger in the beginning of the chapter, when the fire burst, that did not dissuade them. It inflamed them. As soon as God became disciplinary, it seemed to them that the devil was originally right in Genesis 3. He doesn't love us. He hates us. Can't you tell he hates us? Look at what he just did to us. So the word I consider mistranslated as delight in Genesis is then used in 19 verses of the rest of the Old Testament, not written by Moses, when it was only translated delight one time. Genesis 3. Why the translators chose that word, I don't know. Because 16 of the 19 times that it was translated in other places, it's translated in terms of desire, not delight, desire. I want something I don't have. So, we have to answer the question, what created the desire for the forbidden in Eve? Why is the thing that's forbidden always wanted? Why do people want the forbidden? Well, that's a consequence of the fall, but this is where the fall happened in Genesis 3. What created that? I think we have to fall back on the devil's approach in this temptation of Eden. To introduce the God lied so he's not as good as you think he is thesis. He just stuck that in. You won't die. And the great lie then led immediately to the thought that God had forbidden the eating of the fruit of this tree because it would help Eve to see how and why he was being deceitful and evil. She saw that food and longed for it, but she thought she was being prohibited by God from something that was really good for her. And you know, people are like that today. If you tell, especially in our generation, with some of our young people, if you tell them that God wants them to preserve their sexual purity until they're married, they think they're being restricted from something that's good for them. And it's not. It's a terrible disaster. It warps them in all kinds of ways. But that's what was going on. So my conclusion is that the nephesh is at risk if God's not good. So the nephesh must be concerned for the damage that may come. And since your eyes are what tells you what's coming, you use your eyes to protect your soul by looking at what's coming and deciding whether you're going to stand in the way or move. And that's the way we use our eyes all the time now. We protect our physical well-being by looking and seeing. And the danger, of course, for now is that we often anticipate. We look and see something and then we anticipate certain future possibilities, and that's where we go wrong. You shouldn't anticipate. You should just take it like it's coming and depend on God to direct your thinking. So the eyes are an instrument for seeing what's coming and giving help in deciding what's going to be seen as good or hurtful. And that all rests in the question of whether God really is good or not. If God really is good, and all of the information in Genesis 1 and 2 up to chapter 3 was a strong argument that he's good. He provided all the food they could possibly eat, gave them more water than they could drink, because when they ran out from the garden, it turned into four major rivers. They had more to drink and eat than they knew. They had a personal pleasure experience with each other physically at every level. There wasn't anything they didn't have that was really pleasurable experience. So how do you argue that God wasn't good? It was the serpent that wasn't good.
Sin.
It was the serpent believed that created the sin that has caused all of the damage that's done now. There's going to come a day when God will wipe every tear from our eyes and there won't be anything like sin at all anywhere in the kingdom of God. And then we'll know with certainty that God is good. So, I basically have concluded that the issue for the nephesh in its most fundamental concern is the issue of security. The nephesh wants to be secure. It wants to be safe from anybody that would hurt it. And it uses its eyes to try to decide that. So with the body, it's satisfaction. Food, drink, pleasure, and the absence of pain. That's the body. The spirit is the issue of what do I do? And that's the issue of wisdom, the need for wisdom. But the soul is, how do I protect myself? So I just summarize these. Satisfaction for the body, significance for the spirit in terms of being able to be smart enough to do what you need to do, and security for the soul. So those are going to be the three big issues in our study 2 weeks from now as we go to Abraham as an example. Okay?